Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, good friends, and welcome back. Welcome back to the Bill Press Pod. You know, I think there are only two good things you can say about the Donald Trump presidency. Thank God it's over. And thank God we survived it, but barely. Even for those of us who lived and suffered through Trump's time in the White House, it's still hard to believe how bad it was. But as documented in a new book by veteran journalists Susan Glasser and Peter Baker, those 4 years were even worse than we thought. Their new book, The Divider, reflects the great reporting that both authors did, Baker at the New York Times, Glasser at the New Yorker, under Trump. But looking back, it also paints a presidency that was totally out of control, far worse than any we've ever experienced. Baker and Glasser show that the violent attack on the Capitol on January 6th was not an aberration. No. It was the inevitable culmination of the lawlessness and rule-breaking that marked the Trump White House from day one. The Divider. It's an important and compelling read. Its authors, our guests today, are two of America's best political reporters. Susan Glasser, Peter Baker, thank you for joining us on the Bill Press Pod, and welcome.
Thanks for having us, Bill. It's good to talk to you.
Oh, I'm delighted to be with you. Thank you.
Well, and I have to say, congratulations on your new book, The Divider. It really is, first of all, I think it's a culmination of the great reporting both of you have done about the Trump presidency over the last 4 years. It's really a masterpiece of journalism. I was amazed that having lived through this and covered it and wrote and talked about it myself, I still learned a hell of a lot about the Trump presidency from your book. So really good. So, Susan, let me start with you. I guess it's safe to say that never in our history have we had a presidency that came anywhere close to the Trump presidency.
Look, you know, we've had all kinds of, you know, liars and charlatans in public office, of course, in the American experience. But Donald Trump is an outlier in so many ways. And of course, it's in that catastrophic ending to the Trump presidency that you see that most clearly, which is to say he's the only president in American history who has refused to accept the results of an election and has actually sought to overturn a legitimate election, defying the Constitution. That's never happened before. But I think when Peter and I set out to write The Divider, part of it was to not just focus on this culmination, this violent, awful culmination of the Trump presidency, but to make the case that this was almost the inexorable conclusion, an inevitable conclusion of this four-year war that Trump had waged on American institutions.
Well, in fact, that is the very first sentence of the book, which I found just about the most important sentence of the book, right? That what happened, as you point out, eventually on January 6th, wasn't just some aberration, right, Peter? It was... We could have foreseen it, I guess, from the way the whole Trump presidency was carried out, was laid out, and that this was the, to use your phrase again, the inexorable culmination.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, look, that's the important thing, that this, we were building to this moment the entire time.
Yeah.
four-year war on institutions and norms and traditions. And that's, and so no other book has tried to do what we try to do here, is to explain January 6th, not just in the context of the moment, but in the context of the entire presidency. And we should have probably, you know, a lot of people did see it coming, but I think even then it was hard to believe that it was possible that that you could have somebody who was so immune to the, you know, the standards and the norms and the beliefs of a system that we've had now for a couple hundred years. But that's where we were. So by the time January 6th happens, we should have all understood what was coming, partly because he told us it was coming. And even without the inside information that this book provides, you know, he was fairly transparent. He said as early as May of 2020, he wouldn't accept any election result other than a victory. And if it was a defeat for him, that meant it was rigged. So he telegraphed very early on what his plan was. And again, every step along the way of his presidency, you could see in some way or another how he was setting this up.
And it's pretty clear, I thought, that there were two characteristics of the Trump presidency, which you come back to time and time again in the book. One of them, Susan, zero regard for the truth. Right?
Well, that is a fair statement, really. This is a president, after all, who I think the Washington Post assessed more than 30,000 times in the course of his presidency that he made misleading or otherwise untruthful statements. But it's more than that. I mean, it's a kind of lying as pathology that is so extraordinary. Again, we've had liars as presidents before. It's the commingling of a fantastical array of untruths that really sets Donald Trump apart. We experienced that ourselves in the two different interviews we conducted with Trump for this book over three and a half hours. At times, he was contradicting himself, even in the same sentence, within seconds of each other. He told us at one point that the Secret Service had stopped him from going up to the Capitol with his crowd on January 6th. Then, like 90 seconds later, he said, "No, no, I never asked the Secret Service." And then seconds after that, I said, "Well, actually, they stopped me from going." How do you even, what's to believe, what's not to believe with Donald Trump? It's a pathology with him.
You mentioned, I think it's your second interview with Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago, where he started out with another big lie about a COVID vaccine ad. Peter, right. Tell us that story.
Yeah, exactly. So, when we first went to see him was a few months into the Biden presidency, when everybody was sort of taking the vaccine, but a lot of his own supporters were reluctant or skeptical. And we asked him, "Would you do, you know, a public service announcement to tell them that you think this is a good thing?" Since he took it, and he claimed credit for it, and he said, "Yeah, the Biden administration asked him to do that, and he was thinking about doing it." So, okay, 7 months later, fast forward, we go back for our next interview. And he'd never done a PSA. So we asked him, "Well, whatever happened to that PSA you were going to do for a vaccine? Well, I don't know what you're talking about." "Well, you were the ones who told us." So, you know, it was a remarkable thing. Was he lying the first time, or was he lying the second time? Or did he just forget? Or is he just living in a different reality? I mean, this goes to the heart, in a way, of both two things. One, his, as you say, tenuous relationship to the truth, and the question of whether he's lying, he knows he's lying, or he just gets, you know, caught up in these reality bending experiences. Or the second part is, though, how he's captive to his own base. He was afraid of getting too associated with something that he could have bragged about as his biggest accomplishment, because his base was mad at him. They even booed him at a rally about it. So suddenly, instead of being a leader of his base, he's a follower.
Susan, there are a lot of words that I have used and a lot of words I've heard other people use to describe Donald Trump. Of all the many words that one could use, some of them unprintable, why did you decide on, the two of you, on the divider?
You know, we were looking for something that really expressed something about Trump as a person as well as a political figure, in part because he created this remarkable cult of personality around himself. And the story of Trump in the White House that we are attempting to tell is both the story of a politician, but also a guy. And what's remarkable is that Donald Trump is a divider in his personal interactions with people. It's his personal philosophy of how to get ahead in the world. And it's his political recipe for success as well. So it just, it had the effect of drawing together so many different themes around Trump in the White House. Donald Trump divided his own family. He divided his staff members against each other. In fact, that's literally his management philosophy is divide and conquer. And you saw that in the constant toxic infighting of his aides and his family members. This was something that was encouraged by Trump. He had an almost gladiatorial view of life in the Oval Office. He wanted people to fight it out in front of him. He, of course, encouraged the political combat instincts of institutional Washington as well. Whenever there was a chance to double down on something that was divisive or controversial, Trump would take that chance. He was never going to pull the country together. And also that's what makes him stand out compared with all of the other presidents of our modern recent memory. They may not always have succeeded, but they all aspired to unite the country. They saw that as part of the role of being the president. George W. Bush actually literally spoke of being a uniter, not a divider. Barack Obama said there is not a blue America and a red America. There is a United States of America. Bill Clinton talked about his goal of being the repairer of the breach being the partisan breach in the country. And again, of course, they fell short, but that was what they saw as fundamentally the role of the president. Contrast that with Donald Trump and his message in his inaugural address of American carnage.
Yeah. Peter, that was a time when some journalists, but a lot of politicians were saying, well, yeah, he was a divider during the campaign, but once he gets to the White House, man, right, he's going to do like other presidents and want to bring everybody together. As you point out, that hope disappeared in the inaugural address, didn't it?
Pretty quickly. That's right. I think there was a not irrational hope that he would be something different than he presented on the campaign trail, because he wasn't somebody who was rooted in particularly ideological terms. He wasn't a partisan in the past because he'd been a member of every political party multiple times, right? He switched parties five times. He was pro-abortion rights before he was against abortion, pro-gun control till he was against gun control, pro-higher taxes on the rich before he was for lower taxes on the rich. So he had such an ideological flexibility that there was this hope that, okay, fine, he's from New York. He's not like a hard Republican conservative. He'll be willing to deal with people across the aisle because he had to do that as a builder in a Democratic city. But that proved to be wrong, that in fact he had decided to throw his lot in with the right wing of his party because that's where he saw the people who were most faithful and loyal to him, and he decided on a base-only strategy basically for the rest of his presidency.
Does he believe in anything, Susan?
Well, he believes in Donald Trump. He has, in fact, great, great confidence in Donald Trump.
Right. No, I kept looking for that for his core beliefs. I never found them. Maybe you can help me out. The other thing that struck me, so maybe if he doesn't believe anything, he doesn't know a lot either. I mean, as early as page 5 in your book, right, I found this paragraph, if I can read just a little bit of it, about Donald Trump, what he did not know. He did not know that Puerto Rico was part of the United States. Did not know whether Colombia was in North America or South America, thought Finland was part of Russia, mixed up the Baltics with the Balkans. He seemed generally surprised to learn that Abraham Lincoln had been a member of the Republican Party. It's astounding what basic stuff he didn't know.
You know, I have to admit that is actually one of my very favorite paragraphs in the book. So, thank you for that dramatic rendering of it. The thing is that, by the way, he not only confused the Baltics and the Balkans, he did so in a meeting with the leaders of the Baltics for maximal insult. But it's not just ignorance. We have had American presidents who didn't know stuff. Bill Clinton was never really comfortable with foreign affairs till well into his second term. Barack Obama was a very junior senator who had very little Washington experience under his belt. You can read briefing papers. You can learn stuff. Although, of course, Trump was famously uninterested in hearing briefings, never mind reading them. The difference is that Trump was so arrogant. He didn't care. It wasn't just that he was ignorant. It's that he believed it didn't matter and that expertise was something to be devalued and dismissed because he was the expert on literally everything. You know, Peter was there at the CDC in the beginning of the pandemic where Donald Trump actually said, well, he knew a lot about medicine because his uncle had been a professor at MIT. By the way, he wasn't even a professor of medicine. His uncle was a professor of physics.
You also offer some insights into Donald Trump, the person, which I found humorous and interesting. His obsession, among other things, with his own personal image, with whenever photos were taken, you know, how the what angle was shot and the lighting, getting the lighting right and everything. Is that the television producer in him, Peter?
Yeah, it's all about creating an image. It's all about creating the mythology of the great man, right? He was fixated on lighting. He would correct, you know, TV people when they came for interviews and say, no, you want to put the lighting here. He would look at the iPads to look at what the lighting looked like before he began an interview. His very first day, he comes into the Oval Office. And the first thing he says is not, wow, this is a place where great decisions were made, or wow, this is a place where FDR or Reagan or JFK were. His first thing he says in there, how did they get the lighting to do that? And it was an obsession of his. But it's again, it's all part of this idea that he liked to promote, that he was a great man. So much so that it was, you know, he was never he never admitted any kind of weakness. At one point, one of his aides said, you know, the president looks a little tired. And she was corrected by another aide saying, no, Donald Trump is never sick and he is never tired. And that's part of his, you know, mythology that he likes to create, a function of the 14 years of the apprentice when he created a figure that didn't actually match reality. But that was the way he succeeded in entertainment and the way he succeeded at politics.
Now, I must say, one thing you do in your book, which I've not seen anywhere else, is you detail how Donald Trump fixes his hair every day, which I have wondered about as every time I see him, how long it takes and what the process is. Susan, do you care to spell it out? It's pretty detailed and pretty a long time getting that hair just right, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's what's actually kind of remarkable, given the results.
I know.
This would be not only is it labor intensive, but it's very striking that Donald Trump didn't trust anybody else to do his hair, that he's doing this remarkable operation on himself, including to the point of using almost cartoonishly oversized scissors to you know, the kind you use at shopping mall, you know, ribbon cuttings to cut his own hair. And often you notice it gets a little bit long and he has that sort of aging rocker, you know, Allman Brothers kind of feel to it. But, you know, the amount of hairspray, there was a very specific kind of hairspray that his personal aide had to carry around everywhere with him. You know, wherever Donald Trump went, you know, he does this sort of elaborate comb over / flip. In order to obscure the thinning thing, the coloring. I mean, it's all what's amazing, again, from a man who is so obsessed with image that he would put all this effort into something to come up with something that looks so bad.
Yeah, as I recall from reading this, I mean, what you describe, it all has to go forward, right, first, and then some up of the one side, and then it flaps back. I don't know. It's a three-way process, as I recall. But
well, that's right. And the flip is very important because if you don't get it right, then it all sort of, you know, droops and looks really, really scary.
Peter, Susan said something earlier about the distrust as a divider that was inherent among the Trump team. I remember those early days, too. You and I were both there in the briefing room. I mean, the White House, that certainly the early White House, was really a nest of scorpions, wasn't it, among the staff? I mean, nobody trusted each other. They were leaking against each other and plotting against each other.
Oh, literally, exactly. You're exactly right. You rightly say, we knew this at the time, but in going back and doing more reporting after he left office, which is what we did for this book, you know, all of the stuff that came that's new in the book is come from reporting done after he left office, when people were more willing finally to talk a little more candidly, is what you learn is that it was even worse than we thought we knew at the time, right? People would do job interviews and literally interview the person, okay, I need you to be on my team if you come work at the White House. You know, whose team are you going to be on? It's usually not that open, even in other White Houses that have had famously fractious staffs, for a hiring person, a chief of staff or a chief strategist or counselor, to say, I'm going to hire you, but only if you help me defeat other people on the staff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, he really divided that. And also you report that some of the staffers, the people that were most afraid of what Trump might do, I guess, not knowing much or the risks he was willing to take, were the people who worked for him, the people who were closest to him. And at some points, they even were plotting against him to prevent him from taking some of the actions that he wanted to take, Susan?
Yeah, I mean, Bill, this is a very important point. The testimony here is coming from inside the room.
Right. Yeah.
Right. The phone call is coming from inside the room, as the horror movie analogy would have it. And, you know, the people that we spoke with, by and large, were Trump appointees, Trump officials, most of them Republicans or nonpartisan government employees who worked and were promoted by Donald Trump. And, you know, they're the ones who emerged in successive waves from this very high turnover administration with these alarming stories to tell about what the president of the United States was up to. And in a long career in Washington, both Peter and I have spent, you know, the last three decades, most of it here reporting in Washington, never come across anything as alarming in all that time as, you know, understanding the extent to which the senior national security establishment of this country, you know, was terrified both of Trump's effort to politicize the nonpartisan U.S. military and to get it to serve as his own personal Praetorian guard of loyalists, and also to do significant damage to America's international standing. And, you know, that was really summed up. And we obtained for the book a copy of Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, his resignation letter that he wrote to Donald Trump. He did not send it ultimately, but that he wrote in the aftermath of that disastrous June 1st, 2020 Lafayette Square photo op. And in that letter, Milley's language is just unlike any document I've really ever seen. It says the chairman of the Joint Chiefs said that he considered that Trump was doing, quote, grave and irreparable damage to the United States. He said that Trump was, quote, ruining the international order. And he said that he believed that Trump did not subscribe to many of the values and principles for which the United States fought in World War II. In essence, this is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs saying that Donald Trump was the biggest threat to U.S. national security in the world. And this is just a chilling thing. These are not Democrats or Republicans. These type of senior generals are, you know, they worship this constitutional notion of an independent, nonpartisan military.
And yet in the beginning, Peter, we remember when Donald Trump bragged about my generals, surrounded himself with, he loved people in uniform, right? They look like Hollywood casting.
Exactly. And that's what he said, in fact, about some of them. They're straight from central casting. He thought that they were all like Patton. Not Patton in the reality, but Patton the movie. He wanted it to be, you know, these sort of tough, gruff guys, but tough, gruff guys for him. That's what he wanted. He thought that they would be his tough, gruff guys. And he didn't understand the apolitical tradition of the military. He even told this to John Kelly, the former four-star chief. He said, you know, why can't you effing generals be like the German generals? What German generals? The ones in World War II, meaning the Nazi generals. And John Kelly, flabbergasted by this, says, well, you know, they tried to kill Hitler three times, right? So, you know, it wasn't just that he was ignorant of history, but he was ignorant, most importantly, about the tradition of the American military, which doesn't want to be a Praetorian Guard, as Susan said, for a president or a commander in chief. They want to be, you know, a non-political, apolitical force in American society, answerable to presidents of both parties. They're not part of an administration. They belong to the people.
With all of the confusion in the White House, with all of Donald Trump's lack of knowledge or just lack of attention to detail, I'm still amazed looking back at what he was able to get away with. I mean, he never released his tax returns. He never put his businesses in a trust. He kept making money from his properties while he was president of the United States. You know, he had clearly welcomed the Russian assistance in 2016 and got away with it. He tried to bribe the president of Ukraine and got away with it. He unleashed an armed mob on the U.S. Capitol and got away with it. Susan, is he the ultimate Teflon president? You know, I mean, seriously.
You know, look, what I would say, Bill, is that he blew past so many of what we perceive to be the guardrails around the American presidency. And he showed in many cases that you could just, you know, keep on charging even after doing things that would be unthinkable and would sink any other president. And, you know, so for 4 years, right, so many of Trump's opponents were waiting for this accountability moment, you know, the sort of fantasy of the knockout punch. And, you know, even January 6th, of course, did not prove to be that. If anything, I would say the Trump presidency empowered not only him, but potential successors in the Oval Office. Mm-hmm. Certainly their fear of being impeached and removed from office, I think it would be much less. And I do think that the fear of impeachment acted as a certain constraint on American presidents up until now. But Trump has shown that in the state of partisan division that we currently have, it's basically inconceivable that any president would find himself on the losing end of a two-thirds majority in the Senate for conviction. And so, you know, basically impeachment is dead as a practical matter. And that was the main vehicle mm-hmm. that the Constitution's founders set out to rein in and to hold accountable a rogue president. And so I think, if anything, Donald Trump not only got away with a lot of stuff, but he showed other potential successors a roadmap for how to get away with things.
All right, two quick questions before we take a break. And again, the book is The Divider, Trump in the White House 2017 to 2021, Peter Baker and Susan Glasser. Peter, first to you, what does Vladimir Putin have on Donald Trump that explains Donald Trump's continued support of Putin no matter what he does? And as you point out in the book, this goes way back. He was a buddy of Putin or trying to get close to Putin long before he got to the White House. What's that all about?
Well, he really was. You're right. It's not just about politics. Long before, he went to Moscow to have the Miss America pageant there. He wanted to build a tower there. He got a lot of money from the Russians at times when American banks stopped financing him because he couldn't be trusted. So he has a long history, a financial history with Russia. And then there's also, I think, the idea that basically he admires what we call strongmen. You know, he admires people who are like, not just Putin, but Xi Jinping, General Sisi in Egypt, Duterte in the Philippines, Erdogan in Turkey, Kim Jong-un in North Korea. And he expresses, you know, extraordinary affection or admiration for these autocrats, people who are generally not admired by Americans who care about democracy. It was so striking. Mm-hmm. He had that Helsinki summit with, he stood next to Putin's side, and he basically said that he believed Putin when he denied the election interference in 2016, taking his word over that of the intelligence agencies. And not only were reporters in the room like Susan, who was there in Helsinki at the time, shocked, so was the intelligence director that Trump himself appointed, Dan Coats. Dan Coats is a former Republican senator, former chief of staff to Dan Quayle, a conservative appointed by Trump, the director of national intelligence. And he watched this Helsinki press conference with increasing alarm. And he was telling people at that time that maybe it means that Putin really does have something on Trump. Here, this guy had access to all of America's secrets, all of the possible, you know, classified information and everything that the Americans knew about Russia. And even he thought it was possible that the president of the United States was somehow compromised by Russia because it was so otherwise inexplicable.
Yeah, it reminds me of what people used to say about J. Edgar Hoover, right? Nobody was willing to take him on because he had photographs, secret photographs of everybody. And to you, Susan, did Donald Trump really seriously consider making Ivanka his vice presidential running mate?
You know, it's funny. This is actually an example in the book. There's a number of kind of stories like this that I would say we heard about at the time. And even in the context of living through the Trump presidency, it seemed too wacky or like a crazy one-off. And it actually became more worrisome as Peter and I worked on this book and got more reporting and realized many of these really out there ideas were much more seriously considered by Trump over a much longer period of time than we had understood when we first learned about them. Buying Greenland, by the way, is another example of that. But to the question about Ivanka, yes, in the 2016 campaign, he kept pressing his campaign advisors on this, such that even ultimately had to do a poll to assess her as a possible candidate and found out actually to, you know, the concern of the campaign is that she didn't poll as badly as some of the other people they were looking at. Ultimately, Ivanka had to be the one to say, oh, Dad, you know, I don't think that's a good idea. And again, Donald Trump, when he was president, floated and actually seriously considered making Ivanka ambassador to the United Nations or, get this, president of the World Bank. Can you imagine?
No. Yeah, when I read that, I had heard that rumor, but you really brought it to light again, and I was astounded. Well, we can't let Peter Baker and Susan Glasser leave without talking, as the great journalists they are, about Donald Trump and his treatment of and his treatment by the media. We'll do that after a quick break here on the Bill Press Pod. Hang with us. We'll be right back. Okay, friends, we are now just barely a month away from the midterms. More important than ever that every one of us pitch in and do whatever we can to help hold on to the House if we can, to help increase our lead in the Senate, and win some of those important governor's races. And one way to do so, I've urged you before, but I think is still the best way to help these Democratic candidates, is through actblue.com. You can donate to any Democratic candidate for governor, for Senate, state legislature, for the House that you care for, that you want to support. Or through ActBlue, you can give them your money. Just check out their website, actblue.com, and they'll divide it up among the most important races. So if you're interested in those important Senate races, Raphael Warnock in Georgia, Sherry Beasley in North Carolina, Mandela Barnes in Wisconsin, Catherine Cortez Masto in Nevada, Val Demings in Florida, John Fetterman in Pennsylvania, or important governor's races like Beto O'Rourke in Texas, Charlie Crist in Florida, and all the rest, go to actblue.com. They were founded in 2004, they've raised over $11 billion, with a B, $11 billion for Democratic candidates so far. Can't go wrong. Give your money to your candidate of your choice through actblue.com.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
We're back with today's podcast. Very, very honored to have with us Peter Baker and Susan Glasser, who are the authors of The Divider, a great new book out, The Ultimate Word on Donald Trump in the White House, 2017 to 2021. Peter and Susan, Peter, start with you this time. If anything, any phrase, Donald Trump will be remembered for the phrases, I guess, fake news and enemy of the American people. But isn't Donald Trump really, what is this all about? Is this just bluster? I mean, he's really a creation of the media and brilliantly used the media, right?
Yeah, look, he's got a love-hate relationship with the media, right? Obviously, he does, say these things you just mentioned about us. He attacks reporters generally, and he attacks reporters individually. He attacked us when we were, during the presidency. But at the same time, he can't lay off the media because he's just so addicted to it. He is addicted to attention, and media is the way he gets it. And he basically is so covetous of it that he even told A's at one point that, there's no such thing as bad publicity as long as they don't call you a pedophile. That was his standard. As long as they don't call you a pedophile. That was the low bar he set. But you're right. I mean, the thing is, I was with him on Air Force One once when he just started yelling at me and telling me I didn't deserve to cover him and all that kind of stuff. So he has this hostility and so forth. But look, Bill, you and I go back a long way. Susan does too. We've met and seen and covered plenty of presidents. We know that they all get mad or even sometimes despise the media, but they don't do what Trump did. I mean, what Trump did wasn't just calling out reporters he didn't like or individual stories he didn't like or saying the media is unfair. This use of the phrase enemy of the people and this other phrase, fake news, is meant to discredit the very idea of a free press, right? And he was asked why you do this once by Leslie Stahl, and he very upfront told her, because when you guys write something negative about me, I want to have discredited you so nobody will believe it. And that was the goal, to discredit a free media in case it was, wrote anything or said anything about him he didn't like. And that's a pretty, corrosive policy, because it has a greater effect than simply, an individual news organization or reporter. It discredits the whole idea that there's such a thing as an honest and independent press.
Despite going after both of you during his 4 years in the White House, he granted you three interviews at Mar-a-Lago. In your research and writing of this book, Susan, what was that like? What was sitting down with him like? What was his tone? What was the mood? What was the scene at Mar-a-Lago? And did you find him at all repentant?
I don't think that's a word in Trump's vocabulary, Bill. It was interesting to go to Mar-a-Lago. We actually were down there twice, once in the spring of 2021, and then again in November of 2021, and about 3.5 hours. The first time, the interview took place in the lobby of Mar-a-Lago. Trump was arranging this literally as a show. So he's there as sort of a mix of banquet hall greeter meets Napoleon in Elba, right? He literally, you're sitting there and you walk into the main kind of gilded lobby of Mar-a-Lago, and there's a sign up as you walk in, sign up for the Mother's Day brunch now, right? These are, paying customers at Trump's club, and he wants you to sit there so that when the people come in, he's showing off that these, national media figures are there to kiss his ring or whatever. And in fact, you listen to the audio of this interview and he's sort of fulminating about the rigged election and thousands of dead people voting. And then, hey, hi, folks. Hello. Welcome. Nice to see you. And, Kimberly Guilfoyle walks in the middle of one of these interviews. And, she says, oh, will you come down and talk to the crowd at the cocktail party? He says, yes. We ask him, what's it for? When she leaves, he says he has no idea, but goes down nonetheless. And every night that he was around, he would make this show of going to dinner on the patio of Mar-a-Lago. And he would come up, his table was set off by a red velvet rope, as if anyone was going to, take his table. And the people would get up from their dinners and give him a standing ovation.
Oh, wow.
Then the night we were there, Trump would just sit down basically by himself. He had two young aides he had brought with him from the White House. They sat there. He didn't seem to talk to them at all. He was talking on the phone the whole time. And, you know, it was just a very bizarre spectacle. Same thing with the interview. That's really a misnomer. It wasn't an interview in the sense of here's a question and then here's an answer.
Yeah.
It was a monologue, not dissimilar in content to Trump's Twitter feed. You know, there were lots of insulting nicknames and commentary about individuals. There was never kind of a sentence with a noun and a verb and a period. It was essentially sort of an extended ramble through Trump's mind at that particular moment.
Did you walk away from there, Peter, convinced that he has decided to run in 2024?
No, I didn't. You know, look, if he's not going to run, he's not going to tell us that or give any indication of that up until the very last moment, because it's in his interest to keep everybody thinking he is. That's how he keeps the attention, which he desires so much. That's how he keeps the money coming in for fundraising. That's how he keeps the political power that he has. So even if he were not to run, we wouldn't know it or see any indications of it. Having said that, I think it's, you know, if you were a betting person and you had to put money down, I think you'd probably say, yeah, he probably will run at this point. He wants vindication. He thinks that Biden is weak. He thinks that perhaps running will give him some sort of protection from some of these investigations that are going on around him. So in that sense, it does feel like we're heading toward a second Trump possible, well, not a second term, but a second comeback, basically, attempt by President, former President Trump.
And finally, Susan, given what we know, and thanks to you, we know a lot more about the Trump 4 years. Would a second Trump presidency be, given what he was able to get away with in the first 4 years, be even more dangerous than the first?
Well, you know, I think the short answer is very likely yes. There's this very chilling scene in the book. We're interviewing a senior national security official who had observed Trump up close in the Oval Office, who said that he was like the velociraptors in Jurassic Park, you know, in the first movie where the children run into the kitchen to hide and think they're safe, but then click, the doorknob turns, and you realize that the velociraptor has learned to open the door. And I think the point that this official was making was that over 4 years in the White House, Trump learned how to open the door. He got a much better sense of how to operate the machinery of Washington power and how to get what he wanted. And, you know, he wouldn't make the mistake, as he saw it, of hiring generals who weren't loyal to him. He wouldn't make the mistake of having a John Kelly as his chief of staff, as opposed to a Mark Meadows. And, you know, look, when you think about January 6th and what a close run thing it was, that was the term that Mark Milley used for it, recalling Wellington's famous quote after the Battle of Waterloo and what a close run thing it was that he almost didn't beat Napoleon. You know, it was a close run thing. And with a different set of people around him and 4 years of knowledge, Trump would go after accomplishing many of the very, very disruptive or dangerous or even illegal things that he pursued in his first term that he was constrained from doing.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there are lessons that he learned, right, which he would probably just be too happy to apply in a second term, God forbid, with that scary thought. We will move on. And thank you so much. Again, congratulations on the book. We will have a link on our the episode notes to today's podcast for all of our listeners to be able to check in and buy your own copy of The Divider. Highly recommend it. Trump in the White House 2017 and 2021. Thank you, Peter Baker. Thank you, Susan Glasser. Good luck with the book.
Thanks, Bill. This is great. A lot of fun.
Thank you so much.
And that's it for today's podcast with Susan Glasser and Peter Baker. In the episode notes to today's podcast, you'll find a link for you to get your copy of The Divider. Believe me, it's a must read if you care about politics. If you're willing to suffer through another account of the Trump White House, but this is the very best one yet. And that's it for today. So we'll be back on Friday, as always, with our Reporters Roundtable, looking at the continuing aftermath of Hurricane Ian and the response of President Biden and the various governors in the wake of the storm. Take also a look at the latest on the big Senate races and governor's races in the country. All the news from Washington this week. We'll wrap it up with our Reporters Roundtable on Friday. We'll see you then. In the meantime, take care of yourself. Be good, be strong, and come back and see us on the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.